You're listening to the MOA broadcast with Sam Wilson. Will you make it out alive? And we are back from the break. We've got all kinds of good information and a limited amount of time to share it. We've got fan mail or jump in to the plastic sliced cheese. Let's do the fan mail. We haven't done that yet. Let's do that. Here we go. Excuse me. We have two we're going to cover today. These were both sent in via email at the info@gearconvoy.com email address. So we don't have a physical address, and we're not going to name and shame anyone other than first names for the emails. The first one comes to us from Douglas. All right, Douglas, what have you to say? We share the good and the bad here at the MOA broadcast. Hello, I found your knives online and don't understand why you make so many knives with hollow handles. This is true, I make primarily hollow handle survival knives. We'll get to that in a minute. They will never be as strong as a full tang knife and will probably fail you when you need it the most. Even light batoning. Excuse me. For those of you that are not into the bushcraft scene in the outdoor survival knife market, batoning is when you take a knife and you stick it into like a piece of wood and you take another piece of wood and you hammer on the spine of the knife to split wood with it. There are arguments ad infinitum on bushcraft and knife forums about the efficacy of this particular technique. We won't get into that today. We're just going to stick with the email. Even light batoning will probably knock that thing apart. Also, what's up with the bleep bleep? These are unfriendly to radio terms, Hawaiian shirts you wear. So for those of you that don't watch the video version of the podcast or the radio broadcast, this show gets broadcast on the radio Saturday morning at 8 a.m. and Sunday evening at 8 p.m. on the local Southern Oregon radio waves. Then it gets uploaded to become a podcast or a video podcast if you go to our Patreon page and become a member there, and you can watch the video version as well. I wear Hawaiian or Aloha shirts, as they're called. It's something I like to do. To me, it's a personal expression. It puts me in the right mood, so to speak. If you ever go to knife shows or trade shows, you'll see me with a cowboy hat and Hawaiian shirts, and that's just my thing. So we'll get to that in a minute. So to address your questions, Douglas, I make knives with hollow handles because I'm a believer in the concept. There have been some issues with this concept in the past, but this was primarily due to poor design execution. We'll get to that in the next email. But everybody and their brother right now in the knife world makes full tang bushcraft knives. For those of you that don't follow the knife world, a full tang knife simply means where the handle, the steel goes through the handle. You can see steel all the way around the handle. It's just two handle slabs that are attached to the knife, but you can see steel all the way around. Everybody makes those. There is an endless variety of what's called full tang knives. I do something different that very, very few people do, and in my opinion, I do it very well. I make hollow handle survival knives. That may not be your thing. That's okay. You don't have to buy one. You don't have to like the concept. But there is a strong, even if it may be not the largest, it is a strong and healthy following of people that like hollow handle survival knives. This allows you to put a survival kit or gear, or whether it's medication, money, whatever, fire starting materials in the waterproof handle compartment of a knife. You saw these very, very popular in the 80s, and they started to kind of wane from there because they got a lot of them were made, you know, at flea market style junk and so forth. Another topic for another day. But that's why I do it. I've got videos on our YouTube channel at Gear Convoy on YouTube. If you look up Sam Wilson or Wilson Custom Knives, where I am viciously beating on these knives with an axe handle, a club. I'm doing chin-ups off of them. The knives aren't going to fail in anything approaching sane use. So, that being said, buy what you want. Folks, that's the beauty of our market. We are so saturated. We have so many options now that it's unbelievable. Buy what makes you happy. That's the point of it all. As far as the Hawaiian shirts, Douglas with a lowercase d, or should we say Douglas with a small d, I don't spend my time in the basement where you probably do, eating Hot Pockets and Tostino's pizza rolls and have so many red sauce stains on your shirt, it just looks like a Hawaiian shirt. These are actual Hawaiian Aloha shirts designed to look that way because I like it. If you don't like it, that's entirely fine, sir. But I've never really encountered another man that began his issue with another man's appearance or the way he dressed himself. So you do you. I've got good news and bad news. Don't contact me again. I wish you the best. We move on to Jerry. Jerry says, hello, I found your podcast while on your website looking at your knives. This will be gearconvoy.com, I'm assuming. I must admit, after the experiences many of us had in the 80s with the cheap and poorly made hollow-handled survival knives from overseas, I wasn't overly interested in the concept. Yours do seem very well made, though, so I will at least do some more research. One of the things I noticed was that none of the knives on your website are serrated. What are your thoughts on serrations, and why don't any of your knives have them? As this feature seems like it would lend itself well to an emergency. Thank you for your time, and I enjoy the podcast. Sincerely, Jerry. Jerry, you make a couple of good points there. Number one, many of the hollow-handled survival knives that were made and sold both at box stores and flea markets and so forth, catalogs, in the 80s, were junk. They were made overseas. They were made very expediently, very quickly, very cheaply to capitalize on the Rambo knife trend that was popular at the time. Our knives here at Techline Knives and GearConvoy.com, all of the components, everything is done and made here in the U.S. domestically. That is not a cheap way to do things, but our quality control, in my opinion, is second to none. These are very, very close to custom handmade knives. So I'm not really worried about the quality aspect. Again, if you look at the videos we have on our website and our YouTube channel, we have just vicious abuse testing these knives, and they hold up very, very well. So that's not a concern. The serrations is an excellent question. I agree with you. I think serrations are a great idea. For those of you that don't know, serrations on knives are those little scalloped edges you see typically like kind of on a bread knife. Serrations do a couple of things, and I'm going to run out of time. We have so much ahead of us here. But serrations, they give you little points, almost like a saw. So even when the knife becomes dull, you can continue to saw through things. And by those increased, those raised, curved edges, you're effectively lengthening the edge of the knife. Why don't I have knives that have serrations? The answer is very simple. Whether I agree with it or not, most people either have issues sharpening serrations, or they are afraid of them, or don't understand them, or don't want them. The bottom line is the unserrated or non-serrated knives outsell serrated knives with my fan base or customer base on a high level. Many, many more non-serrated knives, so I don't offer the serrations. I do have saw teeth on some of the knives, but that's on the custom side, different stories. So excellent questions, Jerry. Glad you wrote in. Thank you very much, and we appreciate the support. Remember, if you want to write in, info@gearconvoy.com, and if you go to the Gear Convoy website, you can find all kinds of information, including about the MOA broadcast and the video versions and so forth. Now, we are ready to move on to, let's see, where'd it go? Okay, before the break, we talked about a few things, adding butter to coffee. Folks, do some research. I love doing this. I don't usually do it when I'm in public because people either A, don't understand, or B, they just think it's weird and they stare or make comments. At home, though, I typically start my first at least 2 cups of coffee a day with a teaspoon to a tablespoon of grass-fed butter, not margarine, grass-fed butter in my coffee. You should try it. It's a lot better than the synthetic or artificial coffee creamers and all of the chemicals and sweeteners that they have in them. But we're moving on. The next step is the sliced cheese products. Okay. We go to Science Geek. The Science Geek observe, this is some website, I don't know what this guy, if that's his title or that's the name of the article, observe that cheese that comes in plastic wrapping under microscope reveals alarming amount of microplastics. Okay. Sorry, I need a sip. The Australia-based creator took cheese slices wrapped in plastic. We all know what these are. In America, when you're at the supermarket, you see these as the individually packaged in plastic cheese type products that you would use to put, I'm not going to mention name brands, I'm not trying to put throw anybody under the bus, but these are the individually packaged cheese slice products. There's a reason they're often referred to as cheese products instead of cheese. Again, do your own research. I don't want to tell you what to think. We just like to share information and you draw your own conclusions. The Australian-based creator took cheese slices wrapped in plastic, as is done by commercial packaging, that was said to have been sitting in his fridge for years. So I guess he's doing an experiment. He pulls some slices out that have been sitting in his fridge for a while, years allegedly, and we go from here. He quickly peeled out the thin layer of plastic wrap from the cheese, or rather, quote-unquote, plastic cheese, their words, and added small chunks of it into a preparation slide for a microscope. He's going to examine the cheese. Okay, I know why they call this plastic cheese, as in I'm pretty sure we have found microplastics in this cheese, he explained. Displaying the shocking observation, he revealed the cheese bits were covered in microplastics throughout. The cheese does not even need to be plastic wrapped because it's full of microplastic, he said. The microscopic view showcased tiny irregular bits of microplastic spread out on the cheese chunk. Some pieces were elongated and thread-like in shape, while some others appeared like small blobs of plastic. A few even displayed the distinct plastic blue, even at a microscopic level, which further confirms that plastic has managed to penetrate. He speculated whether the cheese even spoiled after being in his fridge for a long time. His words, "This is a heavily processed item, and so it's not surprising to find microplastics in it," he added. Now think about that. The next time you use a pre-sliced cheese product. And what do we know about this cheese product? It doesn't even melt half the time. Have you ever seen somebody make a sandwich or a grilled cheese or put this on a burger? If you do an internet search on this, there are all kinds of videos and images, and I have done this myself in real life. You probably have too. This stuff doesn't even melt the way regular cheese does. Why on earth would you want that in your body? Now, what you do is up to you. Again, we're not here to tell you what to do. If anything, we want to stimulate thinking. Why would you want to do that? Okay, on to our next story. Now, this is the COVID story. Folks, if you remember not that many years ago, masks and COVID-19 and all this, it was the rage. Every story, every day. We saw videos online. We saw news reports of people being dragged out of stores, arrested for not wearing quote-unquote masks properly or the proper type or at all. Again, let me be clear. We are politically neutral. We are not going to get involved in politics. We're not going to tell you what to think. We're just going to give you the info. You draw your own conclusions. But it's undeniable that many people, I remember myself going through stores, I had a mustache at the time. I didn't have my beard, but I had a mustache. If you have a mustache and you're wearing these masks, the mustache naturally pulls the mask down. I remember in one instance, I was literally chased around a grocery store by this little old lady who couldn't have weighed more than 110 pounds at probably 5'2", who was darn near ready to get physical with me because my mustache kept pulling the top of my mask just below the ridge or brim of my nose. It was intense. Okay, we go to Emerging Pathogens Institute, University of Florida. The story was published on May 28th, 2024, so well after the height of the pandemic craze. Now, we're not going to have time to go through all of this. We're going to have to cherry pick, to use that term, some points, and we're going to share them with you. All we want to do, you take this in, stimulate some thinking, and see what you think. First up, confusion about the 6-foot rule. Even after catching on to the dangers of airborne transmission, the world was still paying attention to the wrong thing. The 6-foot rule was created with the idea that big droplets carrying the virus would fall to the ground before they could reach other people. But these were never the biggest threat. The real danger came from fine aerosol particles, which stay airborne long after the person who expelled them has left the room. The 6-foot rule, this refers to the quote-unquote social distancing. There are a lot of studies that have gone back and forth about this. We'll leave that for another time. We're going to move forward. The 6-foot rule, social distancing, helped to slightly reduce the risk of transmission in large spaces. In smaller spaces, though, an entire room could quickly fill with aerosol particles. People might still be safe if the space had frequent air turnover, but older buildings without proper ventilation could be especially dangerous. My interpretation of what they're saying is if you're in a well-ventilated modern building that had good air movement and handling, this might help. If you're in a smaller, older building, this essentially meant very little, is what they're saying. More people started wearing masks once they realized COVID-19 was primarily transmitted through the air. But many masks didn't effectively filter out tiny aerosol particles because they weren't woven finely enough. In the case of cloth masks, think of people that were wearing bandanas pulled up over their faces, bandanas that are so loosely woven that you can see light through them, and in some cases almost read print through the mask. Versus a microscopic virus that's airborne. Again, draw your own conclusions. Or because they gaped at the sides in the case of common surgical masks. These are the surgical masks that you saw people put on that you could literally slide your hand into on the side of their face, on their cheeks. Are they really stopping microscopic particles of a virus when you can slide your hand through the mask and the seal on your face, especially if you have a beard or large facial hair? It's not forming a seal. Now, they added that N95 masks, which form a tight seal around the nose and mouth, I would argue that because I have used literally in various trades I've worked in over the years, hundreds upon hundreds. For years, there were jobs where I would wear a brand new N95 mask a day while doing my job. I've used a lot of N95 masks. They do not form an airtight seal, as it says here around the nose and mouth, at any time. In fact, if you take that N95 mask off at the end of the day and look in the mirror, typically at the bottom of your chin and around your nose, you can see where dust particles that are large enough to see in the air have collected around your nose and your chin where you've drawn them in. At that point in time, I didn't even have a beard. If you're wearing a beard, these masks are going to do even less. Again, I'm not saying they're worthless. Draw your own conclusions. But the N95 mask, especially for people that have facial hair, they do not form. To form a seal, you have to have a respirator. Respirators are made of silicone or similar materials. They actually lock on. They seal to your face. And they form the seal all the way around your breathing areas. N95 masks, for the most part, do not do that. But anyway, we move on. The N95 masks, which form a tight seal around the nose and mouth, were the safest. I won't argue they were safer than many others, but they're not locking it out like a cartridge or an air-fed respirator. And let's not even get into the people that were wearing safety glasses and a plastic face shield. Remember those people? We'd see them walking around. They had safety glasses like you wear in a wood shop. and one of those big, large face shields that's just over their face. What is that filtering out? Again, draw your own conclusions. Now, we go to our next study. This is the headline, then I'll get into the story. Wearing face masks did not reduce risk of COVID infection after first Omicron wave, research shows. Again, Thursday, the 16th of May, 2024. This was not done during the height of the pandemic, but after, when a lot of research started to kind of focus and the hysteria settled down. Let me get a sip here. Okay. Let's get into this one. We're going to have to trim some of this because we're running out of time rapidly. I appreciate your attention. New research from the University of East Anglia has found that wearing face masks did not lower the risk of COVID infection following the initial surge of the Omicron variant. The analysis of official data found that several risk factors for infection altered significantly as the dominant variant in the UK changed from Delta to Omicron in December 2021. What they're saying is, as the different variants changed, basically the effectiveness of certain strategies changed as well. Our research shows that there were changes in some risk factors around the time that the Omicron variant became dominant. The co-author of the study said this isn't totally surprising because laboratory evidence suggests that the Omicron variant was better able to infect the cells lining the upper respiratory tract than previous variants, and so was more transmissible. Now, I don't have time. This was a long study. I didn't have time to. I can't condense it into a broadcast to get all this information. So we've got a couple of bullet points that I found most interesting. Excuse me. Again, we're cherry picking some of these so you can look at the study yourself and draw your own conclusions. The study found that changes to risk factors included in November 2021. Always wearing face masks at work, school, or enclosed spaces was associated with reduced risk of being infected in both adults and children. But after the first Omicron wave, it was not. Okay, so at one point masks are making a big difference, and then all of a sudden they're not. Interesting. Early overseas travel was not associated with increased risk, but later on, it was. So I don't know if COVID or Omicron had their visa revoked or what, but apparently later on, overseas travel was associated with increased risk. Interesting. Next point. Being of ethnic minority was strongly associated with increased risk in the first few months of the UK epidemic, but was associated with lower risk and no significant trend change during the study's full monitoring period. So, again, I'm not a scientist and I don't have all of the data. These are just the bullet points they gave us. But according to this, it seems to me, what I draw from this is, in the beginning, COVID was racist against ethnic minorities, and then it became enlightened and was no longer racist against ethnic minorities. Interesting. Okay, the researchers said the balance of evidence is that wearing face coverings reduces transmission of respiratory infections in community settings and did reduce transmission of COVID-19. That was their conclusion. Okay. The question, however, is by how much? I'll just be blunt. After reading a number of these research papers and so forth, that was not my question. But again, we're here to report the facts. You draw your own conclusion. All right, we're going to wrap it up. We move to Florida. We go to Florida. Once again, Babson Park, Florida. A 911 call is shedding light on what happened when an alligator attacked a woman who was kayaking with a group of 30 people on Monday in a canal near the Polk Osceola County line. This is Florida, man. There's a group of 30 people kayaking and a woman is attacked by an alligator. Let's get to it. Around 1 p.m., a man called 911 and reported that two people had been bitten by an alligator while the group was kayaking on a canal. The caller explained the group launched their kayaks at Lake Kissimmee State Park, and they were on their way back to Lake Kissimmee when the attack happened. He later said only one woman had been bitten by the gator and that the reptile had taken a life jacket. So this alligator comes up, bites this woman in a kayak. It appears he drug her out of the kayak because later in the story she's referred to as being in the water. And then he took some guy's life jacket. These gators almost have as much of a bad attitude as the kangaroos do down in Australia. The operator told him to help was on the way and to clean the wound, get a cloth on it, yada, yada, yada. They found a first aid kit in the boat, but nobody wanted to go into the water to get it because they were scared of the gator. I don't blame them. I would be scared too, frankly. He said the gator was still in the middle of the channel messing around with the so this gator, I guess, is thrashing around with his life vest. They couldn't see the gator, but they saw the life vest moving around, so they thought the reptile was in the water underneath the vest. A little more than 30 minutes into the call, the caller said he could see and hear a helicopter circling overhead. A kayaker waved a paddle to signal in the helicopter. The helicopter landed, got on an airboat, and reached the kayakers about 45 minutes after 911 was called. That's not a bad response, really, when you think about where they're at in the middle of nowhere, potentially. I think that particular area is about an hour or so east of Tampa in central Florida. The woman was taken to an area hospital with an injury to her elbow. It is unclear what condition she is in. Now, it mentions the help on the rescue people on the helicopter took an airboat. Briefly, years ago, I took an airboat ride in the Everglades of Florida. As we got deeper and deeper into the swamps or whatever they call it there, we kept hitting these logs in the airboat. Airboats are really cool. It was a neat experience. If you ever get the chance, go for it. But we kept hitting these logs in this airboat. And when we stopped for a break and they turned the engine down, it was very loud. I remember asking the operator, what are these logs that we keep hitting? And he said, they're not logs. They're alligators. So if our airboat died, we're literally in alligator-infested waters. It was wild. That's Florida, folks, for you. All right, remember, don't wait until you have an emergency to prepare for it. If you do, it may be too late. If you don't make it out alive, you don't make it out at all. Stay safe out there, folks.